Good morning. Happy Sabbath. That was beautiful music. Thank you. Sort of enchanting. Really appreciated that. Well, I don't know if we look like we're refreshed. The bachelors have been on vacation for about 8 or 10 days. We were in Florida seeing some family. Got together with all the kids and grandkids and went and saw 90-year-old aunt up in Jacksonville. Used to live on the reservation, married to my uncle. And so it was nice getting some time away. But any of you ever have to come home from a vacation and recover? That doesn't make sense, does it? But it is good to be home. And but it was also nice to spend some time with family. Message today is really a simple one. Doesn't need to be long. Doesn't mean it won't be, but it doesn't need to be long. And it's dealing with the subject of soldiers and suicide missions. Now, right away, when you hear the word suicide, it conjures up unpleasant thoughts, and we're not talking about a person who is committing self-murder. That's a whole other study and article in itself, and fraught with all kinds of moral dilemmas and questions. But really, what we're talking about in this message is the attitude of soldiers who are willing to lay down their lives for a cause, even though they know that they'll be lost in the process, because it's all about something bigger than themselves. And history, and even the Bible, is full of stories of soldiers that were willing to make that sacrifice, go out on what you would call a one-way mission or a suicide mission. I was looking at some notes from history, and I think this comes from the Greek historian Herodotus, that when King Xerxes of Persia was retreating from a battle with the Greeks, I believe, crossing the Mediterranean, he and his crack group of troops, his honor guard that always stayed with the king personally, they acquired some Phoenician ships, they rented some Phoenician ships to cross the Mediterranean, and en route they encountered a very serious storm. And in the midst of that storm, the captain came to King Xerxes and said, unless the boat is lightened by at least half, it's hopeless, we're going down. And so the king called to his troops on the ship and said, I'm your king and my life and my safety is now in your hands. And he explained what the captain had told him, at which point, reportedly, a large number of his troops bowed to the king and then threw themselves overboard. And they did it voluntarily. And you hear a number of stories like this in history. I read another one about Alexander the Great in 331 BC, also from Herodotus, when he was marching towards India with his armies, and he'd conquered much of the known world at the time. He encountered one city that was up on a bluff, and when he, through a translator, asked them to retreat or to surrender, they laughed and said, well, we've got food and water to withstand a siege, and you'll never conquer us. We'll be able to hold you off. And at that point, Alexander, who with his troops, he was on a mesa, a hill on the opposite side of a valley, communicating with the city. They could look from the walls of the city and see Alexander and his troops just beyond bowshot on the other mountain. And Alexander called together some of his elite troops, and he ordered them to line up and face a precipice, single file, one line. And then he gave the order and told them to begin to march. And he said, march forward. At which point the soldiers, with all of their armor and gear, marched towards the cliff. And without hesitation, one, two, three, they just marched off and fell to their death. And when they got to 11, he called for them to halt. And then again through the translator, he spoke back to this king within his capital city and said, surrender or we will conquer you. At which point they had a council, and the king and his general said, we cannot withstand soldiers that are that committed to their cause that they would march off a cliff and die. Said, we're not going to win this battle. And they then negotiated terms and they surrendered. When they saw the dedication of Alexander's soldiers, they decided that the battle was already lost. And I've often thought, if earthly soldiers can be that dedicated to bad kings, then what would happen to the world if Christ's soldiers would have that same kind of spirit of self-sacrifice for our King and the same unquestioning willingness to obey His orders? What would the world do? What would the world see? 2 Timothy 2, verse 3, "You therefore must endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life that he might please him who has enlisted him as a soldier." When you go into battle and you're preoccupied and entangled with the affairs of other things, it's hard to be a good soldier. You know, before the children of Israel would go out to a battle, Moses instructed them that the priests were to address the soldiers. And listen to what he said. And this is, by the way, Deuteronomy 20, verse 5. The priest was to go out before the troops, and he was to shout for them. Deuteronomy 20, verse 5, you might want to follow. "Then the officers will speak to the people, saying, 'What man is there who has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man dedicate it.'" You've built a house, but you haven't had a chance to move in yet. "And what man is there who has planted a vineyard, but you've not yet eaten from it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man eat of it. And what man is there who is betrothed to a woman who has not married her?" You're engaged, but you haven't been married yet. "Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man marry her." And in addition, he would also say, "And what man is there among you who is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go home." Because your fear can be contagious and spread through the troops, and everyone will run when you turn and flee. Just go home. Now, you notice that even though they were fighting, and even though the Lord was among them, and God's priest was to make this announcement, God did not say, "There isn't a chance you might die in the battle." He said, "You might die in the battle." And there's some things that we hope every man could experience in this life. Build a house and plant a vineyard and have a family. And you know, if you're on the verge of those things and other people have had the pleasure of enjoying those things, let those troops go forward. You go home. That's an interesting announcement to make. I don't think that the U.S. Army does that. Where they're soldiers. But the point, I thought, was they didn't want to go into battle with their minds somewhere else. If they were preoccupied with the house that they were building or the vineyard they had planted or their wedding plans, then they couldn't be really focused on the battle that was before them. You know, even in the American military, I think it's the same for all branches of service. There's a contract. How many former service people do we have here? We're thankful for what you've done, but you probably remember that there's a contract. And it says, "You are required to obey all lawful orders and perform all assigned duties." And then they'd fill out something. "I, insert your name, do solemnly swear or affirm that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and that I will, among other things, obey the orders of the President of the United States and the orders of the officers appointed over me according to the regulations of the Uniform Code." It's a declaration, it's a covenant to obey. And every now and then young people will say, "Pastor Doug, I'm thinking of entering the military service. What do you think about that?" And I say, "Well, that's a difficult answer, and I'll tell you why. First of all, I am very, very thankful for the military. We have a son that was in the Marines and a daughter that was in the Army. They did not ask our permission, but that's just a fact. But I am so thankful for the freedoms that we enjoy. But for a Bible Christian, when you willingly enlist in the Army, you are agreeing to obey orders that may create a moral dilemma for you, and they'll be asking you to do things, not to mention the environment isn't always the most sacred environment with young soldiers. Things are even becoming more complex now with some of the new rules. But just thought I'd mention that since it came up. But the point is, you are agreeing to, with very little question, obey orders. Now, they have put some caveats in there, because following World War II, some of the soldiers in charge of concentration camps, when they were tried, they said, I knew it was wrong, but we had to obey orders. And since then, a number of governments have said, all lawful orders. So if you were, because some soldiers were commanded, do not take any prisoners, even if they surrender. Well, that's illegal, according to any conventions of war. But it used to be in the old days, back in the days of Alexander and Xerxes, you obey all orders without question, trusting that your king will not ask you to do anything that is not appropriate. Now, do we ever have a reason to not trust the orders that our king gives us? Or can we faithfully carry out all the orders of Jesus? You remember the story of Gideon? Did that look like a suicide mission? I mean, here he starts out with about 30,000 going against, well, let me read it to you, Judges 7, verse 12. Now the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the people of the east were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number. I think it tells us that one group had like 600,000 in it, but it mentions this was a conglomerate of three groups. And then God whittles down his army. First, he gets it from 32,000 down to 10,000. He says, you still have too many. And he gets it down to 300. You know why God told him the army was too big? He didn't want them going into battle thinking that they had won by their courage and exploits. And it's interesting that he sifted out two groups. First, he said, if anyone's afraid, go home. That's when they lost. They went from 32,000 down to 10,000. Then he brought them down to the water, and they were to all drink, and Gideon and some clerks took careful note, and anyone that kind of just stuck his face in the water and drank without being vigilant, they were eliminated. So he got rid of two groups. He got rid of the fearful, and he got rid of the foolhardy. God wants you to have courage, but he doesn't want you to be reckless. God wants you to have faith, but he doesn't want you to be idiotic. Have you ever met people that said, I got faith, and they do the strangest things in the name of faith? Christians ought to have some prudence to use their faith judiciously. And then Gideon went into battle with that group. Wouldn't you think it's a suicide mission? 300 against a million? You know, the Bible basically teaches that you and God always equal a majority. That's right. If you're going into battle and you know you're fighting with the cause of Christ, you cannot lose. Oh, wait, Pastor Doug, are you telling me that God's soldiers never die? No. If you're fighting in God's battle and you're saved, what do you lose if you die on the battlefield? What's your next conscious thought? You're better off than the one who survived. Right? If you go into battle knowing that you're saved, and you're fighting for the Lord's cause, then you have nothing to be afraid of. The story of David and Goliath. Why is that such a legendary story? Didn't it look like a suicide mission? Matter of fact, I think that when David went to King Saul and said, let me go fight the giant, Saul sized him up and he thought, I'm speculating, this is just me, reading what I know about Saul. Saul thought, well, if we send our best soldier against them and he's killed, well, then we're going to have to be their servants and we look bad. If we send this young whippersnapper out, kid, he's probably 17 at the time, maybe 20. You weren't legally allowed to be a soldier until you were at least 20. He loses, they're going to feel guilty. And they won't be able to brag very much because, after all, we just sent a kid against them. And he thought, what have we got to lose? He's got a lot of pluck. Let's send him out. But everybody thought, If you were on the front lines, it's amazing. Someday I will. I'll call up the video. I'll ask the angel where the DVDs are of earthly Bible history, and I want to see the playback of this. But I would like to have seen the Jewish soldiers on the front lines taking bets when they saw David going down against the giant on what his odds were. I don't think they were very good. I thought they were probably betting how long it would take for the giant to dispatch him. And so it just looked like a suicide mission. But you and God are always a majority. You know, David, he not only went into battle when the odds were against him, he went into the battle with confidence that he would win, which really doesn't sound like a suicide mission. Now, you see so many stories in the Bible of soldiers that obeyed orders of even bad or worldly kings who are willing to die to obey those orders. Now that's kind of inspired me. I remember one time when after 9/11 that that was a very troubling event, and there was a big discussion that was happening in the media. Someone had called the perpetrators that hijacked the jets cowards. And some people took issue with that and said, were they really cowards? Is that the right word? Despicable. Evil. Well, there's lots of words, but were they cowards in that they were willing to die for what they believed in? And you'll see examples of people who are brave and wrong in the Bible. You ever thought about Pharaoh's soldiers? That they were willing to go chasing after the children of Israel down in the Red Sea. Now think about what they had seen the week immediately prior to that. Think about all the judgments and the evidence of God's power that they had seen. You think about even when they were chasing the Israelites, when they finally changed their mind after the plague of death went through Egypt and all the firstborn were slain. Some of them might have been angry also, but then the Bible tells us, the Egyptians urged the people to send them out of the land in haste. They said to Pharaoh, we're all dead men, let them go. The people, and no doubt the soldiers, they said, we're doomed. But Pharaoh was so proud and stubborn, like the devil. And he told his soldiers to mount up and put on their armor and to get their chariots and to chase after the Israelites. Why did we let them go? And it says, when the Pharaoh and his army began to approach the Israelites and they're up against the Red Sea, the angel of God who had been going before the camp, there's a glowing angel, he moved and he went behind them, and the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them. They saw this evidence of God's protection in this cloud that blocked them from attacking the Israelites. And then overnight, God blew that wind and parted the sea, and the children of Israel marched across. And it says in Exodus 14:22, so the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on the right. Ever seen that? Without the help of a glass aquarium? Just the wall standing up. They could look off in the shallow parts of the sea. They could see the creatures swimming. The wall, the water was a wall on the right and the left. And the Egyptians pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea. All the Pharaoh's horses and his chariots and his horsemen. Now, if you were a soldier in Pharaoh's army, after all that you had seen, all the power of God and the pillar of fire and the walls of water standing up, wouldn't you think, maybe the Lord's with them? Maybe they're the good guys and we're the bad guys. And when the Pharaoh says, charge, would you want to obey that order? Wouldn't that look like a suicide mission? Wouldn't you at least be a little apprehensive that this was not going to end well? But they obeyed. It's like the story of when Daniel, book of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they don't bow down when the king tells them to bow down. The king has a tantrum. He says, heat the furnace 7 times hotter than it's supposed to be heated. And he gets the bravest soldiers in his army. And this is Daniel 3, verse 19. He was full of fury, and the expression of his face changed towards Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And he spoke and he commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it's usually heated. You ever been standing by a really big fire. I wish you could be with me. Karen and I, we built some fires where, you know, we don't sit around and just take a few twigs and lay it on the fire. We don't just take the chainsaw and throw a few logs in the fire. I get a bulldozer. And I bulldoze a dead brush up into a big pile, so you're actually driving up on top of this pile. And then after you have a little bit of rain, you set that on fire. Boy, I'll tell you, that's something to behold. And you can see it from 20 miles away. It's really exciting. It could be cold. The boys and I and Karen, they know what I'm talking about. It could be cold and rainy, but the fire is so hot that if you're near the fire, it won't rain on you because the raindrops evaporate before they hit you. So when I read about Nebuchadnezzar getting that furnace 7 times hotter, and I've gone some heavy logs I wanted to throw in the fire, you know, you want to get it in the fire for it to burn. You run up and you throw it and you feel your hands burning because you get too close. And so I know what this must have been like. I've had my hair singed because I got too close before. That's actually what happened to me. I had a full head of hair before I started burning brush. And it says, then these men were bound in their coats and their trousers, their turbans and other garments, and they were cast in the fire. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flames of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, the way I picture this is, first they tied up Shadrach. Maybe they tied them all three up, and they had two soldiers, one holding the arms and legs on one side, one holding the arms and legs on the other side, so a total maybe 6 soldiers, 2 for each victim. And the 2 soldiers that had Shadrach, they said, one said, if we run for it, maybe there's a chance. But we got to obey the king's command. They've got to go in the furnace. 1, 2, run. They run up and they throw them, but the blast from the heat is so hot that they just wither there. But they managed to get him in the midst of the furnace. It says they fell down in the midst. They had to get him in the middle of this raging fire. Now, you're the second group. You see that the first 2 soldiers, they're charring right now. They're dead. And you know you got to throw Meshach in. And the king says, in they go. And they go 1, 2, 3. They run up and they die. And now, how do you feel if you're the 3rd set of 2 soldiers that got to throw Abednego in? Would you want to talk to the king and say, can we wait till it cools off just a little bit? Can we develop a catapult and catapult them in? Do we have to really throw them in? They didn't even question. They just obeyed. Or maybe you've heard the story in the Bible, and you can find this one in 2 Kings, where Elijah is sitting up on a hill. Yeah. 2 Kings chapter 1, verse 9. Elijah makes this proclamation. The king of Israel was sick, and he wanted to find out if he was going to get better. And so he sent a message through his heralds to Baal-zebub, the god of Ekron, to find out if he'd get better. And God was so indignant that here you got the king of Israel. Instead of asking him or their prophets if he'd get better, they go to the pagan god. And so God told Elijah to intercept his messengers. And Elijah says, is there no God in Israel that you're going to Baal-zebub, the god of Ekron, to inquire? Go back and tell the king, you will surely die. So the messengers go back and they tell the king, before we ever got to Baal-zebub, some hairy prophet told us to go back and tell you that you're not going to get better. He said, what did he look like? Well, he was covered with a hairy garment. And he had long hair and a leather belt. He said, that's Elijah. You remember where he was? Yeah, he was sitting by this hill. Take 50 soldiers, go arrest him. And so the king sends a captain with 50 soldiers to go arrest Elijah. Now Elijah's sitting up on this little hill. They can talk to him. And they get to the foot of the hill and they call and they say, man of God, right then. I mean, if you call a man of God, you'd want to be careful, right? They said, man of God, come down. The king, you're under arrest. The king wants you. And Elijah says, if I'm a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and burn up you and your 50 soldiers. That's what it says. We'll deal with why this all happens another time. But He said it, fire comes down from God out of heaven and burns up these soldiers. That's not like lightning striking one person. This is like lightning striking 50 people and they're just charred. Well, the king is back wondering what's taking him so long because he hadn't been very far away. And he gets another captain and 50 soldiers, says, go arrest Elijah. So when that captain and his 50 soldiers come to the spot, they see all the charred soldiers and horses in a smoldering heap, and there's Elijah still sitting up on the hill. I would have said, I'll be right back, and let me go talk to the king and say, let me tell you what happened before we follow through with this order. But he doesn't. He's received an order from the king. And he says, man of God, come down right now. And Elijah says, if I'm a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and burn up you and your 50 soldiers. Whew. Fire comes down, burns them up. Now there's 100 soldiers and possibly horses that are smoldering there at the foot of this hill. The king is waiting and waiting, wondering what's taking so long. Maybe some messengers came back and said, the hell, we got burned up. And the king, stubborn, not very smart, says, get another captain and 50 soldiers. I mean, it tells you something about the devil. He's on his own suicide mission, isn't he? The devil come down with great wrath because he knows his time is short. That's Revelation 12. He's just going to take down as many with him as he can. So this poor third captain and his 50 soldiers are sent. He comes now gently to the foot of the hill. He sees now the remnants of these hundreds of comrades that have all been destroyed. And there's Elijah by himself up on the hill. And he at least is reasonable. He says, oh, man of God. He says, I've got orders. I have to obey. I'm paraphrasing. These other captains and their 50 soldiers came to arrest you and they've been burned up. Will you please come? And Elijah says, since you've asked me nicely, I'll come. Well, God told him, don't be afraid. It saved his life. But you notice, he still obeyed the orders that the king gave him. And that's just one sample of many in the Bible of these soldiers that were willing to sacrifice their lives and obey. You know, Jesus said in Luke 14, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and his mother, his wife and his children, his brothers, and when he says hate here, that's actually a difficult word. It really can be translated as love less supremely. His father and his mother, his brothers and sisters, and yes, his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. He doesn't say it's going to be difficult. He doesn't say that you can't be a very good disciple. Jesus said, you cannot be my disciple. That means all that the Lord is saying there, he's not saying don't love your father, mother, wife, children. He's saying if you love them more than you love me, you cannot be my disciple. You need to be loving them more than you love your community. More than you love you need to love me more than you love your community, more than you love, I love my nation, I love America, but the day may come where I'm going to have to choose to obey God instead of my country. You know what I'm saying? I think Christians should obey the laws of the land as long as the laws of the land don't conflict with our primary king, which is Jesus. And I've seen a lot of people put their family ahead of the Lord, but he says you can't really be his soldier in his army with that attitude. Listen to how Paul puts it. But even I, if I am being poured out like a drink offering upon the sacrifice of service of your faith, I rejoice and share my joy with you all. That's Philippians 2:17. Look at Philippians 3:8. More than that, I count all things to be loss in view of the surpassing value of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things and counted them but rubbish in order that I might gain Christ. You know, one of the keys for soldiers, especially in the ancient days, is they travel light. They don't travel so light anymore. I mean, they can carry tanks and helicopters. But the old soldiers, you had to put it all on your back. And Paul is basically saying, as a soldier of Christ, I count all things nothing that I might gain Christ. Jesus said in Luke 17:10, "So likewise, when you have done all things that you are commanded, say, 'We are unprofitable servants. We have done what was our duty to do.'" Our duty is to obey the Lord and do what He says. You know, so many people read the story about David and Bathsheba, and everybody gets distracted with the titillating part of that tale about David and Bathsheba. And for me, I think the most amazing thing in that story is Uriah, who only says one verse in the whole story. He only utters one thing. Tells us, the Bible says, he was one of David's mighty men. They did some wonderful exploits. Tells us that he wasn't even a Jew by birth, but he was a Hittite, meaning that he was a Hittite that converted to worship the God of Israel. And we know that because of what he said. When David kept trying to get Uriah to go to his house and spend the night with his wife so that nobody would suspect that David was really going to be the father of her baby, Uriah wouldn't go. David tried to get him to go. David gave him catered food. David gave him alcohol to get him drunk and lower his resistance to conscience. And finally, David said, "What in the world is wrong with you? You've been out in the field eating soldier food for months." They've been besieging the city of the capital of Ammon, the Ammonites. And says, "I bring you back to the palace. I give you food fit for a king. I tell you to, you know, go and visit your beautiful wife. You get the most beautiful wife in the kingdom. And you don't go home? What kind of man is that? What wife would understand that?" And you know what Uriah says? "The ark of God, the people of God, and my commanders are out in the field fighting a battle. What kind of captain am I going to be if I go home and eat and drink and sleep with my wife when the battle is not over?" And he would not go down to his own home. He was so focused on the command to win the battle that David then gives him a note. It's basically his own death warrant. He doesn't know that because it's sealed. It's rolled up and sealed. He says, "I've got battle plans for Joab. These are top secret." He knew he could trust Uriah so much that he would not peek. Think about that. David wrote in there, "Take Uriah and set him at the front of the hottest battle and then withdraw, retreat from him, that he is smitten and that he dies." And he hands that message to his friend. Isn't that something? You know, Jesus' betrayal is also in this book, written before it happened by a friend. And Uriah, he knew he could trust Uriah that he wouldn't peek. He was that trustworthy. He could give him his own death warrant and he wouldn't even peek at it. Wouldn't look in the envelope. And he takes it, he gives it to Joab. Joab reads it, looks at Uriah, looks at the note, looks at Uriah. Joab, also an obedient soldier. He doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know why David would say this. All he knows is he has it. It's sealed with David's seal. It's signed with David's name. David is his king. He said, "Uriah is a good man." Not today. We would be thinking, "Oh, he should have questioned that." We're not going into all the ethics and morals of that. All I'm trying to say is the soldiers in God's army back then obeyed without question. And here we debate everything Jesus tells us to do, right? They were bad generals and bad kings. And then Uriah is told to go to a part of the city and charge the wall, which is a suicide mission, and attack a place where they knew the most valiant soldiers were. You can read about it here. 2 Samuel 11. "So it was while Joab besieged the city that he assigned Uriah to a place where he knew they were valiant." They were difficult, tough fighting men. "And the men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the people of the servants of David fell, and Uriah the Hittite fell also." Joab told Uriah, "I want you and your men to charge the gate, to charge the wall. We'll cover you. We'll have our arrows and our spears, and we'll fire at the men on the wall. We'll cover you. Charge the gates." And Uriah heard that, and he thought, this is a suicide mission. But he was a soldier, and that was his command, and he obeyed. And what was really sad is they charged the gates, and Joab, remember what David's order said, withdraw from him. They didn't cover him when they said, "We've got your back," and he died. I expect to see Uriah in heaven. I think he went down fighting going to be a very interesting reunion when you see Uriah, David, and Bathsheba in heaven, looking at the replay. A loyal soldier, willing to sacrifice all for his king. You know, the Bible tells us that soldiers should not question God's orders. Not everyone, Jesus said, that says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but they that do the will, those that obey the will of my Father, which is in heaven. Heard about a mother that got exasperated. It seemed like whatever she told little Billy, he did the opposite thing. He just delighted in rebelling against his mother, and she became so fed up. She finally said to him, you do whatever you feel like doing. And then she said, now let me see you disobey that order. How does a kid disobey that? And sometimes that boy, we're so bent on just doing our own thing. We're called to be living sacrifices for the Lord. Romans 12, 1 and 2. I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you might prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. If when we accept Jesus, we really are crucified with Christ. You know, if a soldier knows that he's got a terminal disease, follow me. Soldier finds out that he's got a terminal disease and he's going to die in a week, but you're going to have perfect health for the first 6 days. If he volunteers for a suicide mission, what has he got to be afraid of? Right? See what I'm saying? If you have really been crucified with Christ and you've put all on the altar, what do you have to be afraid of? Nothing. John 10, 17. Jesus said, therefore my Father loves me because I laid down my life that I might take it again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of myself. I've got power to lay it down and I've got power to take it again. Was Jesus on a suicide mission? In a sense. You know, a lot of soldiers, they may not even be believers, but they're programmed to die gloriously. Look at all the communists that don't believe in God that died, sacrificed their lives. I've got friends that were in the Korean War. I've got one friend, he manned a machine gun. And he said that their guns nearly melted firing at the Korean soldiers that were coming over the hill, and the first waves knew they were going to get mowed down. But they kept coming, fighting for a cause that says there's no God. Why can't we, who do have a cause and do believe in God and don't believe that death is the end, what are we afraid of? Being a Christian is sort of a suicide mission. Did you know that? But it's really the beginning of living. Romans 5, 6. For when we were still without strength, in due time, Christ died for the ungodly. For scarcely for a righteous man will one die. Yet perhaps for a good man, some would even dare to die. You all hear these wonderful stories of soldiers that someone throws a grenade in a group and one of them leaps upon the grenade to save their buddies. And they're willing to die for fellow soldiers. Some people, I heard a story not too long ago. Somebody fell into Angel Falls up in Yosemite. A boy fell in. He was being swept over and some Marine jumped in to save him, knowing it was very likely he would not be able to pull him out of the current, and they both went over. Total stranger. What possesses somebody to do that? He says, even for a stranger, some people would dare to die. But God demonstrates his love for us in that he really died for us while we were enemies. Was that a suicide mission? Was Samson a suicide mission? When he said, Lord, fill me with the Spirit, and the last thing I'm going to do with your power is lay down my life to deliver God's people from their enemies. And God answered his prayer and filled him with the Spirit. And then he basically was filled with the Spirit to lay down his life and bring down the temple of Dagon. It's what Jesus did last thing before he died. He stretched out his arms and he laid down his life. He said, it is finished, to bring down the temples of the devil. Something like a suicide mission. Notice Romans 6, verse 6, and I'm just about done. Romans 6, verse 6, knowing this, that our old man was crucified with him. When you decide to follow Christ, Jesus said, it was our opening verse, we take up our cross. Our old man is crucified with him, that the body of sin might be done away with, that we should no longer be slaves. I don't want to be a slave to sin. For he that has died has been freed from sin. You ever think about death liberating you? You ever visit someone in the hospital racked with some kind of painful final illness and they're praying they can die? They're in that limbo, knowing that they don't have a future, not wanting to suffer anymore, and death for them represents a freedom. You know, as long as we're captive to sin, we're in slavery. But when we truly surrender, yeah, it's laying down your life and saying, I'm willing to sign up for a suicide mission and be a Christian. Where does Jesus say we take our cross when we follow him? To our crucifixion. Where does anyone take their cross? He that is dead is freed from sin. Think about that. Hebrews 2, verse 14. Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he, Jesus, likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who has the power of death, that is the devil, and release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime in bondage. Through Christ, it says the devil has the power of death, but through Christ's sacrifice, when we make up our minds to follow him, we are freed from the fear of death. We don't have to be in bondage anymore. Best summary verse for this is probably Galatians chapter 2, verse 20. I have been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life that I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Now, why am I saying all this? If I was to summarize the essence of all this, it would be a soldier can never be as courageous and effective as he or she needs to be if they're worried about saving their lives in a dangerous battle. If they make up their minds before they go into battle, I'm going to count myself already dead. I've heard a lot of stories. My dad was in World War II, and I've heard a lot of stories of soldiers who said, I just made up my mind that I wasn't going to live, and I had to stop worrying about that so I could focus on my mission. And they said, surprisingly, I lived. But they were able to be victorious and successful because they made up their minds that their lives were not the issue anymore. That was a done deal. Then they had to focus on what the mission was. If we, well, what a church we'd have. If we would really, I'm talking about this, and we'll say amen and we'll go home. But if God's church would ever really capture that truth, that we really take up our cross and say, I am not going to live for myself anymore. I'm just going to live for God. Wow, the world's yet to see what can happen. Well, we did see, first century. They counted not their lives dear unto themselves, that they might obtain a better resurrection. And if we make up our minds when we accept Jesus, I'm dead to myself, the devil can't take your life if you've already given it. You have nothing to be afraid of. Right? You know, I remember reading in history about a particular soldier in the Swiss Confederacy that was in a battle with the Austrians. And the little Swiss army was small, and the Austrians had a very big army. And they were out on this field of battle by a creek, and the Austrians presented a formidable defense that was just, they had all these spears. It was before the days of firearms in 1386. And it was between Leopold III, Duke of Austria, and the old Swiss Confederacy. And the Austrians put up this wall of spears, and the Swiss soldiers knew that they couldn't get past it. And if they could breach this unbroken wall of spears, just like cactus that were facing them, that they could get through the lines, and then they had a fighting chance because they were tall and they were a little more dedicated. It's more like the Spartans. You know who guards the Vatican? Swiss soldiers. The Swiss guard. And this one particular soldier, Arnold Winkeland, he told his friends, he said, "You follow me, and I will create a break for you in the wall of the enemy." And he charged with his friends, his fellow soldiers behind him. He charged up to the line of spears. He turned sharply, grabbed as many spears as he could with his long arms, pulled them in. He knew the other soldiers would be preoccupied with spearing him. And while he did that, it created a breach, and his soldiers, his army, was able to go through that temporary break and finally get a foothold, and the Swiss won the battle. And they made him a hero because of that. He decided that someone's going to have to lay down their life in order for the victory to be won. If every Christian would really say, "Lord, I trust you. You will never give me a bad order." And orders will no longer be debated and dissected and discussed. Orders will be obeyed. And we are willing to follow you wherever you lead. You know what Jesus said to Peter? Just before he went to heaven? He said, "Peter, when you were young," the first thing he says, "Peter, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me?" Remember? Peter said, "Lord, I love you. I love you. I love you." He said, "Okay. When you were young, you went, you girded yourself and you went where you wanted. But when you are old, someone else will gird you and you're going to go where you don't want, and you will stretch forth your hands." In other words, and then he said, "Follow me. Follow me." If you're going to follow Jesus, how did Jesus die? He stretched forth his hands. How did Peter die? History tells us he was crucified, but he said, "I'm not worthy to be crucified like Jesus. Crucify me upside down." Peter knew ahead of time that he was going to die. But once he had that settled, he wasn't afraid. You remember when Peter was sleeping in prison on death row? Why wasn't he afraid? How could he sleep? "So I died already. May as well get a good night's sleep now." There's a peace that passes understanding, and there's a power that comes into the church when we really can embrace this idea that being a Christian is a suicide mission. Not suicide that you physically take your life, because that's self-murder. That's the antithesis of what I'm talking about. Suicide in that you give your life. You lay your life down that you can really live, that others can live, that God can be glorified. And that's my desire. And I don't know that I'm there yet, but that's where I want to be. That's where I know I need to be. And I know that's what God's Word teaches. I hope that's the kind of church we're going to be that will really demonstrate, saying, "I'm going to live for Christ." Is that your prayer? We're going to sing our closing song. I think it's "Beneath the Cross of Jesus," but I forget the number. 303. Why don't we stand as we sing?